You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Lindsay Hilsum, an award-winning reporter and editor for Britain's Channel 4 News, has spent much of her career covering conflicts around the world. She was among the first foreign correspondents to enter Libya in February 2011 to cover some of the earliest protests being staged against its unpredictable dictator, Muammar Gaddafi. And she was still there 8 months later when the man who called himself brother leader or the guide was brutally murdered by rebel forces. Ms. Hilsum describes how Libya's revolution unfolded from her own observations and through the stories told to her by the many ordinary Libyans she came to know during her time there in her book called Sandstorm. It's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here.
The day after Gaddafi's death, you drove from Tripoli to Misrata to meet the rebels who'd captured him, and you were able to examine the things that Gaddafi had had with him when he died, a cell phone, an African good luck amulet, an assault rifle, and his famous golden pistol. Weren't you even permitted to hold the golden pistol?
Yes, that was one of the most extraordinary moments, that they had laid out these treasures on a sort of rickety table. And somebody handed me this golden pistol, which had it was strangely beautiful, you know. I mean, I wouldn't think of a pistol as being beautiful, but it was. And it had like a fleur-de-lis pattern on it. And it said in Arabic that the sun would never set on his rule. Well, the sun had set on his rule by then.
Mm-hmm. Do you know who gave it to him?
I don't actually. No, I'm not sure who gave it to him. He was given many presents and many gifts over the years.
The men you met with told you that they'd captured Gaddafi, but that they hadn't killed him. He had died of a pretty violent death.
It was very sad.
Do you think they were lying to you?
I don't know if they were lying to me. It may not have been them, but they were certainly there. He was torn limb from limb. It was a pretty desperate and sordid end.
And then his body was put on public display in Misrata. Did it attract many people?
Oh, yes. I mean, the body was in a terrible state, as you could imagine, if somebody has been basically beaten to death. It was put in a meat storage facility, and Libyans filed past with their mobile phones taking pictures. And I mean, to me, maybe to us, that's like a gruesome scene. But I think for Libyans, it was very important to know that he was dead. And they couldn't quite believe he was dead because he had had such power over their lives for 42 years. Somehow seeing him taking those pictures made it real.
Although you report that you spoke to one woman who had worked for him who said that she still didn't believe that he was dead.
Yes, she was an extraordinary, extraordinary young woman. I call her Razia in the book. That's actually not her name. She asked me to give her a different name because she was worried that people would wreak revenge on her for supporting Gaddafi. But she still loved him. And she had worked with his wife and daughters as a protocol person. And she, when I spoke to her, she had like sort of hero worship in her eyes. I mean, she spoke to him in breathless tones. For him, he was some kind of magical creature.
And we tend to forget that, despite the fact that many people hated a vicious dictator like Gaddafi, and there have been a number of others, there were always true believers, very strong followers, and that was the case in Libya as well.
Yes. I mean, I don't have any doubt that the vast majority of Libyans wanted rid of him, had enough, and he ruled through fear. I mean, people were terrified of stating any opposition to him, and even some of those who you would see jumping up and down shouting his praises were doing it not because they really meant it. But yes, there was a hardcore of people in Libya who, I mean, he was charismatic, strange but charismatic. So people who followed him, and people, of course, as within any dictatorship, who benefited from his rule.
The death of a tyrant can bring a sense of catharsis, but didn't the Libyans that you spoke with tell you that Gaddafi's death hadn't really brought them peace?
I think people found it very hard to believe that this had happened. I mean, one of the people whose stories I tell in the book is a woman called Huda Abu Zaid, whose father had been in the opposition, and they had lived in exile for many years. And one day she came into the shop which her father ran in West London and found his body lying there in a pool of blood, his face distorted by meat skewers. He had been murdered by the regime. Now, she went and saw the body of Gaddafi as it lay in Misrata. And I asked her afterwards what that was like. And she said, you know, I looked at him and I thought, he's so small, he's just a man. And then she began to cry and she said, you know, I realized that the last time I'd seen a body in a state like that was when I saw my father's body.
You spoke to a young female dentist from Ceuta who told you that she was concerned about the culture of violence that Gaddafi had created. She said, we each have Gaddafi inside of us. Muammar killed us, and we think the solution is more killing.
Yeah, I thought that was such a perceptive comment, the idea that every Libyan has a little Gaddafi in their head. Because when you look at the legacy of these 42 years of dictatorship, there are weapons everywhere. That's the legacy. There's no functioning government. There's no real state. That's another legacy. But the main legacy, I think, is psychological. Because there's no... people aren't used to compromise, negotiation. They're used to everything being settled through violence because that's the way he ruled.
Well, also, we've seen this again and again. People are interested in revenge and in looting rather than establishing a new government right away.
There certainly has been have been revenge killings. There's been very little looting, and that's one of the interesting things in Libya. Because I was in Iraq as well, back in 2003 when Saddam Hussein was overthrown, and there was a huge amount of looting. One of the things which was interesting and impressive to me at that point when Gaddafi fell was actually the only places which were looted were his palaces and huge houses and those of his family. But ordinary shops and so on were not looted. And Libyans did seem to have a sense of discipline and a sense that they shouldn't do that because they needed to build a country. Unfortunately, I think that what's happening now is it's a problem because all these young men who picked up guns, they don't want to put them down again.
My guest is Lindsay Hilsum. Her book, Sandstorm, Libya in the Time of Revolution. Perhaps before we deal a bit more with Gaddafi, we should talk about what Libya was like before he came to power. King Idris, he was welcome because King Idris was not a popular ruler.
Well, King Idris was, they called him the reluctant monarch. He was just a bit useless, really. I mean, he didn't really seem to want to rule. He was from the east of the country, from Benghazi, and he wanted to stay there. He didn't, even though Tripoli was supposed to be the capital and the east and the west of the country united, he just didn't really do very much. And next door in Egypt at that time, in the 50s and 60s, you had the great pan-Arabist leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser. And so when Gaddafi seized power as a young military officer in 1969 and said that he was going to be like Nasser, many people in Libya said, fantastic, that's what we need.
Well, but Libya also had to overcome the legacy of colonialism, in this case the Italians, who had imprisoned some 100,000 Bedouins who had resisted their rule, kept them in concentration camps, and many of them died there.
Absolutely.
Is there still anger toward Italy?
Not really.
Because the countries are pretty close geographically.
Yes, they are. And obviously, you know, a colonial history has a legacy in itself, and people talk about that time. But I think that people do also see it as being a product of the fascists of Mussolini, not of, you know, Italy today or the Italian government today. What actually is more resented is the fact that Berlusconi, the former leader of Italy, was very, very close to Gaddafi. And people in Libya who I know resent that much more than the old colonial times.
When Gaddafi seized power, was oil already a major source of income?
It had just started. It was found in the 50s. And Libya has great oil and gas reserves. And Gaddafi played an enormously important role in the whole of the Middle East because you remember the oil boom of the 1970s when the price of oil really shot up. It was Gaddafi who started that because Gaddafi was the first person to take on the oil majors and say, hang on, we whose countries in which the oil lies are not getting enough of a share. And so he just said, right, you know, you're going to be nationalized and you've got to pay more money. And the oil companies had no choice.
Well, earlier when Mossadegh tried to do something similar
in Iran,
the CIA played a role in overthrowing him. And the CIA and some other Western countries had rather close relations with King Idris. Why didn't they do the same thing they'd done with the Shah?
Well, I think that they knew that that it wasn't viable to try and get the monarchy back, that the monarchy had been very weak. And I think that in the beginning, they thought that Gaddafi might be an ally. I think that they certainly didn't predict that he would become what Ronald Reagan called this mad dog of the Middle East.
And he was welcomed by the Libyan people initially. You've included photographs in your book of Gaddafi from the early 70s, and one he's dressed in a military uniform and he's smiling at the camera, and another he's stretched out reading on what looks like a beach blanket. When you first came across these photos, were you surprised at how handsome he used
Absolutely.
To be?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a...
He almost has movie star looks.
He does. And I mean, this is an archive of photographs which was found by Human Rights Watch in the ruins of the government buildings when Gaddafi fell. And many of these photographs have never been seen before of the 70s and 80s. And yes, I mean, Gaddafi is super handsome. And he has this very clear skin and these thick eyebrows.
So what happened? It was a plastic surgery that did him in?
Well, I think that Gaddafi is just a classic example of someone where, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And he became crazier as the years went on. But you can see even from the beginning he had a thing about hats, you know. He was always wearing a different kind of hat and then a different kind of robe. And then, you know, sometimes he would dress up in these crazy military uniforms where you'd have endless medals across his chest. God knows which campaigns he got those medals in. And then by the end, I mean, he was like a sort of sinister Middle Eastern Michael Jackson.
Yeah, you say that he had so many Botox treatments that he came to resemble the equivalent of Michael Jackson. In the early photos, he looks relaxed and reasonable, very different from the crazed person we see later. Do you think that he did change?
Oh, yeah, and there's no question that he changed. But I think that also you can say that he showed his true colors pretty early on. He gave us a speech in the early 70s, in 1973, where he made it clear that he would never brook any opposition and that anybody who tried to oppose him simply would be killed. That was that.
Oh, even people who didn't oppose him. You spoke to a man named Mohammed Mustafa Saudi, a metal worker, who makes parts for minarets, and he told you how much he'd admired Gaddafi in the early days, and then it ended when he was kidnapped and forced to spend 11 years fighting in the Libyan army.
One of the joys about researching this book was people were able to tell me their stories for the first time, because in 42 years they'd never been able to talk freely. And Mohammed Mustafa Saadi was one of these people telling me this story of his life, which was basically the story of Libya, of originally loving Gaddafi, demonstrating on his behalf, then you'd go home from work and find that there was a gallows in the street and people were hanging from it. And then he thought, this isn't right. And then, as you say, he was kidnapped and forced to serve in the army. He had to fight. Gaddafi started a war in Chad, the next door country. Now, that's the most futile war, I think, ever. It was over a 60-kilometer-wide strip of desert. I have to tell you, if there's something Libya doesn't need, it's a bit more desert.
Is it much different from what happened when Saddam Hussein attacked Iran?
Yeah, I mean, Iran is...
Kuwait was oil.
That was a war between two powers. I'm not saying it was a good thing, but it was a war between two powers. Chad was just a broken down and useless state full of sand and very underdeveloped. And that was just Gaddafi had this idea that he should rule a much bigger country than Libya. Libya wasn't a big enough canvas for the kind of painting that he wanted to make.
My guest is Lindsay Hilsum, who is the international editor for Britain's Channel 4 News. She appears regularly on PBS's NewsHour, CNN, and NBC. And she has written a book called Sandstorm, Libya in the Time of Revolution. It is published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Lindsay Hilsum, H-I-L-S-U-M. Her latest is a book called Sandstorm, Libya and the Time of Revolution. It's published by Penguin. And before we go back to the story of Muammar Gaddafi. There's still fighting going on in Libya, isn't there? Yesterday, 30 people were arrested after a group of armed ex-rebels seized control of Tripoli's airport. They were demanding the release of a rebel leader. Is the political situation in Libya still very much in flux?
Well, I think that anybody who thought you were going to go from 42 years of dictatorship to democracy overnight was dreaming. And so, yes, it is very much in flux. A lot of the militiamen who were the ones who overthrew Gaddafi, they took part in the revolution, they have not laid down their weapons. And that's because there's no really strong central authority at the moment. So they don't feel that if they lay down their weapons, that they'll be secure. And I think it's also because they've never had so much fun. I think that if you're a young man in Libya, the idea of hurtling around on a souped-up vehicle with a Kalashnikov is the most fun you've ever had. It's a difficult and complex situation, and I do think it's going to take quite a long time to settle down.
So the top has been taken off of the pressure cooker, and now it's hard to put it back on. But what was that like for you? This was a dangerous time. You're a Westerner. You're a woman. I don't know if you speak Arabic.
Not very well. No. I work with translators.
So were they welcoming?
Totally. Absolutely. I mean, one of the things about when the revolution started last February, we drove over the border from Egypt. And the first thing we saw was a graffiti on the wall on the Libyan side saying, "Welcome to a free Libya." And a man who looked like Rambo with long dark hair and a bandana and bullets, all around his chest. I mean, he really did look the part. And he said, "I will be your guide and I will help you." And because at that point, people who were rising against Gaddafi felt it was very important to get the word out that the world should know. And so they were unbelievably hospitable to us, putting us up in their houses. To begin with, when we hired drivers and vehicles, they didn't want us to pay. They were so keen to have Western journalists there.
And it had been extremely risky for Libyans to say anything against Colonel Gaddafi during the 42 years he ruled that country. So I guess they were happy to be able to say whatever they thought.
Oh, they were thrilled. I mean, it was an incredible flowering of freedom of expression. I mean, a lot of graffiti, a lot of street art. I mean, people, I remember when I first got to Benghazi, just seeing these cartoons of Gaddafi on the wall. Gaddafi, being somebody kicking him up the backside. I mean, that kind of thing, they'd never been able to do that before.
He had his a book, a green book. I guess it was inspired by Mao's little red book. How would you describe his rule? Did he see himself as somebody who was inspired by Mao's China, or was he just your standard totalitarian, banana republic dictator?
No, I think he was inspired by Mao, and I think
a philosophy of
he had a philosophy. It was a bit bonkers. I mean, he was also inspired by Nasser, but when you read the Green Book, it's a mixture of sort of fairly kind of well-worn socialism and some very strange ideas. I mean, one of the things he says is that it is a definite fact that both men and women are human beings. Well, that's good, because I wasn't sure about that before. But he has very strong views on things like bringing up children. He says it's not good that children should stay in nurseries. And his evidence for this is that the meat of a chicken who has been raised free range tastes much better than the meat of a chicken who has been brought up in a battery. So that proves it, really, doesn't it?
And people went along with this?
No, I think most people thought it was absolute nonsense. But it's all to do with power structures, because what he founded were what he called revolutionary committees, and they were basically the neighborhood thugs. And the Green Book was just a way of rallying these people, and they terrorized neighborhoods and they terrorized people, and they were the ones who, if you said anything against Gaddafi, would beat you up.
You said that the relatives of prisoners who had been killed in a massacre in Libya's notorious Abu Salim prison in 1996 were among the first people to come forward to tell you their stories. Why do you think that they wanted to speak out in particular?
Because they had nursed this pain and grief and resentment for so many years. What happened was in 1996, there was this prison, Abu Salim. There were many political prisoners in there, people who had tried to oppose Gaddafi, including some who were Islamists. They rioted for better conditions. Many of them were dying of TB and starvation. And they thought that they had a deal done with the authorities that they would get better conditions. But instead, what the authorities did was that they rounded them up, put them in a courtyard. Soldiers were mounted on the walls around, and they killed the lot. They massacred 1,270 men. And one of the things I have in the book is I have eyewitness accounts of this massacre, and I think that it is probably the first full account of the massacre that we've had. One of the men who saw it from his cell told me how he saw the walls of that courtyard turning red with blood. Well, it's not surprising then, is it, that the relatives were the ones to lead the revolution. You don't forget that if that happens to your father or your son.
Although they had no idea for years that their relatives had been killed.
Yeah, one of the most extraordinary things I found was I met a man who told me how his brother-in-law had been in the prison and that how he used to take food up for him and toiletries and clothes and so on. And the guards would say, well, you can't see him, just leave it at the gate. And so he would do that. And he said we did that for 14 years before they told us he was dead.
Well, and many people even heard about Abu Salim prison?
You know, I feel it's one of these things I feel sort of guilty about that I didn't know. I mean, we know about Halabja, don't we, and Saddam Hussein, the gassing of the Kurds. But the Abu Salim massacre was covered up. It did leak out little bits and pieces of information, but it wasn't really for 10 years before it became at all well known. And by then, you know, the world was in a different place and people would say, oh, well, that was something that happened before and maybe Gaddafi has changed. And it wasn't really until I got to Libya last year and met these families and understood their grief that I understood how terrible this thing had been and how central it is to understanding why there was a revolution against Gaddafi.
At one point, it was reported that Gaddafi had driven a bulldozer through the gate of a prison in Tripoli and released about 400 prisoners. That was a different prison altogether.
That was a different prison, and that was one of his nutty ideas. He suddenly decided that he was sort of annoyed that he was being told off for having political prisoners. So he said, right, we will let the prisoners free. And he just got into the cab of the bulldozer himself and drove through and let the prisoners out. But most of those prisoners weren't political prisoners. They were thugs and murderers and rapists and thieves.
But he did have a flair for the dramatic.
Oh, that was one of the things he loved doing. And then he was forever going off to the borders of Libya and knocking down walls and saying, now we are one country with Tunisia, or now we are one country with Egypt, whether or not the rulers of those countries liked it or not.
And he offered himself up as the president of a United States of Africa.
King of Kings, I think you should call him. King of Kings of Africa, His Majesty.
And was he very upset when that idea was rejected?
Well, he found ways around it. I mean, he did have some popularity in Africa, much more than in the Arab world.
Because he was seen as somebody who stood up to the West?
He was seen as somebody who stood up to the West, and also he provided quite a lot of weapons, and he provided quite a lot of money. So he was much more popular there than amongst the Arab countries. Arab leaders didn't like him because he had this really irritating habit of trying to assassinate them. And they just don't go for that for some reason.
Lindsay Hilsum watched the revolution in Libya unfold firsthand. She's written about it in her new book called Sandstorm. It's just out from Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You said you came to understand that the Abu Salim massacre had an impact on nearly everyone you met in Libya. How did one event end up touching so many people? We are talking about almost 1,300 prisoners being killed, but this is a country with a fairly large population.
Well, it's a small population. It's 6 million. And people are divided into families and clans and tribes. And family is really central in Libya. This is what everybody is loyal to. And so if you kill that many men, it really does affect an awful lot of families. You know, a family in Libya can be 100 or 200 people. So it really, the impact of it was absolutely massive, particularly in the east of the country.
When the revolution began in February 2011, Gaddafi began to hire mercenaries, mostly from other African countries, to fight for him. Did he turn to outsiders because he understood that many people in Libya wouldn't fight against against members of their own family?
Yeah, I think that he knew that Libyans would find it very hard to kill other Libyans.
Or members of their group.
Or members of their, yes, or members of their tribe and family, absolutely.
And we still call them tribes? I mean, they're still
tribal. They call themselves tribes, but I mean, it's not sort of a simple thing, you know, one tribe pitted against another tribe. Tribal loyalty is one of the different loyalties that people have, but obviously tribes get divided. And so it's not a simple thing. But yes, there are tribal divisions in Libya.
Several Libyans told you that Gaddafi's decision to hire mercenaries was the last straw.
Yes, I think that what Libyans felt a great sense of humiliation that they were still being ruled by this maniac dictator. And I think that the idea that he would bring in foreigners to kill them and to put down the revolution that they had started was really, really too much.
You document how the United States and Britain changed their attitudes towards Gaddafi after the 9/11 attacks in New York. What changed?
Well, basically, my enemy's enemy is my friend. That's what happened. That Gaddafi had been very involved in terrorism and probably with the Lockerbie air disaster in the 80s.
And then welcomed back the man
But they welcomed him back because, basically, he said he had got out of the terrorism business. And the people who were trying to overthrow him in Libya were Islamists, jihadis, the same people, he said, who had done 9/11. Now, they weren't exactly the same people, but they were people who moved in the same circles as Osama bin Laden and so on, and some of them were based in Afghanistan. And Gaddafi did a very good job on persuading the British and American governments that to forget the past, to forget Lockerbie, to forget all the human rights abuse, because now, he said, the people trying to overthrow me are the ones who are going to attack you.
And his decision to dismantle his nuclear arsenal was hailed as a great victory
for the Bush administration. Yeah, it was. I mean, he had some chemical weapons, and he'd started to build. He'd tried to work on the nuclear arsenal. He'd got some bits and pieces in. I mean, he'd got a sort of kit of parts, but he hadn't actually done anything with it yet. But yes, I mean, that was another thing that he did to come back into the international fold, which is what he wanted to do.
You're right that during the 42 years he controlled Libya, Gaddafi had dismantled or disbanded almost every public or private institution that might have provided the country with structure or order. Policing was done by Gaddafi loyalists. You've described as armed thugs. Were you able to learn if there had been any method behind his apparent madness? Was this all just a matter of his maintaining total control?
Yeah, I think that the method was that there would be like government, but then a parallel structure, which was his own personal structure, which was mainly done through the family. So, for example, you might have the head of intelligence, but his brother-in-law, Abdullah Senussi, was the one who was really in charge of that. So he would be sent off on different missions for Gaddafi. So it was a way of keeping everyone guessing and making sure that everyone was beholden to him. So in that sense, as a method of keeping power, it was very effective. As a method of running a country, it was disastrous.
Well, did he build up the infrastructure? After all, there was a lot of money from the oil that was, you know, that was keeping the country going.
Yeah, in the beginning, he did build the infrastructure because the king really had done very little. And he expanded educational opportunities and women started to go to university and so on. He did do some very, very good things for the people at the beginning. But then he stopped doing that and the infrastructure crumbled. And now Libyans, they say, well, look, we have all this oil and gas. Our country, we could look like Dubai with all these sort of shiny buildings and so on. But actually, when you look at Tripoli, apart from a few new shiny buildings, I mean, you know, it's hard to walk across the pavement without breaking your ankle.
He did build a giant water tunnel, didn't he?
This was the most extraordinary thing, the great man-made river. This was his idea of bringing water from underneath the desert in the south to the northern seafront, which is where the large amount of population is. And these water pipes that he had made were so enormous and the project was so ambitious that Western governments thought it must be some kind of secret bunkers for hiding weapons in, because they couldn't believe that anybody would do something which was so environmentally insecure and on such a huge scale and so expensive.
Since he was so much in control, I would guess that it would be hard to find anybody who could manage the country who hadn't worked for him. And I've read that Mahmoud Jibril, the interim prime minister, and Mustafa Abdel Jalil, the interim president, both had positions under the old regime.
Well, this is one of the issues. And Jalil, who was the interim president, is most Libyans I know think he's a good man. He was justice minister under Gaddafi, and he tried to get justice for the Abu Salim massacre families. He failed, but people felt that he'd done a good thing. You know, that's one of the difficulties that Libyans have, which is, you know, many of their best people went abroad. And that means that they have had a good education and maybe some very good experience in business or academia or whatever. But no one has the experience of making decisions and running things. And that's what's really difficult.
I heard a report today about the tensions in Tunisia between the people who would like to see a more secular state and the ones who are Islamists of varying degrees of commitment, including ones who are very strict Islamists. And I'm assuming the same thing is happening in Libya. We're seeing it to some degree in Egypt as well.
Yes, the same divisions are there. And I think that what happens in Libya will be very influenced, particularly by what happens in Egypt, you know, the much bigger country with a much more advanced political system. Most of the Libyans I know would regard themselves as conservative Muslims, but that doesn't mean that they want an Islamic state. But yes, it's a big division within the society. And if they do move to a real democracy, that's one of the things they're going to have to work out, whether a majority wants a secular state or whether a majority wants an Islamic state.
What's your sense? It's mine that, at least for the time being, they will all become Islamic states of varying degrees, the same sort of thing that we've seen in Turkey.
I think that that's a phase that those countries are going to have to go through. And I agree with you. I think that Libya is likely to become... I don't think it's going to become an Islamic state like, you know, the Taliban ruling in Afghanistan. But
or even the mullahs ruling
in Iran. No, I don't think it's going to be like that. But yes, I think it will be a fairly strict state. And I think that there's going to be a big argument within Libya about the role of women.
But it is interesting that most of the secular states... were secular because of leaders like Gaddafi, the Assads in Syria.
That's right. And so what happened was because all opposition was suppressed and really the mosque was the only place to go where you could gather and where people could start to form any kind of opposition movement. So I think it's partly because of those dictatorships that you have the rise of Islamism. It's the only well-organized force that you have in these countries.
Will we see the same thing in Algeria?
Probably.
Where there's been a civil war.
Well, you've had a civil war on that, yes.
Lindsay Hilsum's book, Sandstorm, Libya in the Time of Revolution, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure. ¶¶